Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was young, so
hello and welcome to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and at his home lakeside studio, George P. Fraser, a man who's getting really good at not holding down an actual job. George, welcome.
Hey, thanks for acknowledging that, Bill. Yeah. A lot of effort has gone into that.
No. It is not something that you take lightly, which I appreciate about you. You're all
well,
in, George.
I think it's a gift, Bill, and mm-hmm. and I really can't take credit. It's a gift.
Yeah. So tonight, we've got a great story coming up in just a few minutes. We're going to chat with Rosella. She has been in support groups, Al-Anon and others, for 40-plus years, and there's a lot to gain from people hearing the experiences of being in community like that, George.
Absolutely, Bill. Absolutely there is. And one of the things we can get is to see what happens when you get honest, that a lot of times we think life is going along great, we're doing great, people in our lives are doing great, and something happens. We had COVID the last year. Hopefully it's winding down, but we don't know that. I didn't see that coming, Bill. That changed a lot of things for everybody. Some maybe permanently. How do you adjust to that? We're all pretty good when everything's going our way. We're praising God and we're feeling great. And I think the tendency, Bill, maybe is for some of us that we're getting rewarded for our good behavior. Mm-hmm. I know it's not a quid pro quo with God, but we're human, you know?
Mm-hmm.
God must really like me because he made me George. No, that kind of deal. And then when things happen, you get an illness, maybe you get into a relationship that doesn't work out that well, maybe your business took a hit. Where I'm going with this is we're not in charge of anything and we have power over nothing. And the step that is, we admitted we were powerless over drugs, alcohol, everything in life, and that our lives are unmanageable. It's interesting to me, Bill, when I'm struggling, I'm a lot closer to God than when everything's flying right. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to change that over the years. That's a oversimplification. But there's kind of a tendency, I think, on a lot of our parts that when things are going well, he's got to help other people at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're struggling, you know, it's our first call for help.
Yeah. George, talk a little bit about the strategies that people who are active in their addiction will do to protect that addiction, to protect their drinking or using, how they will go on the attack of people close to them, people they love, in order to keep using.
Well, I'd like to help you with that, Bill, but I don't know anything about that.
You got to be able to speak from some experience, right?
Oh, gosh.
36 plus years ago, though, for you.
I think it comes naturally for me. I'm an excellent liar, and I just told you the truth with
right.
that, okay?
Yeah.
I think we're willing to do whatever we can to keep using, and somebody might give us some loving, caring, concern, feedback, whatever. We're going to try to minimize that, might even turn it on them in order to justify and rationalize so we can keep doing what we're doing. And a lot of times, you're not aware of it. Addiction is more powerful than anything I've ever experienced of problems in that it becomes your God.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of changing, not doing it, doesn't enter your mind. I remember when I was in treatment the third time, I didn't want to do everything all at once.
Did you have a punch card?
No, but unlike some people, I only did each grade once, and I'll just leave it at that, okay?
All right.
But I should have had a punch card. But what it was is the guy, my counselor asked me the last treatment I was in, do you love your dad more than you love cocaine? And I said, hey, buddy, watch it, okay? Or I'm coming over there. I was dead serious. And I'm still a little bit of a punker, and I really was back then. He goes, I'm sorry if I offended you. Let me rephrase it. I go, that's better. He said, did you ever lie to your father so you could do cocaine? I said, I'm not sure I know what you mean. He said, I think you do, but here's an example. Were you ever going to meet your dad for something and you called to cancel with a fake excuse so you could go do cocaine? Well, I did that all the time with everybody, mm-hmm. including my dad. Mm-hmm. And it was like somebody drove a spike through my heart. It was a moment of mental clarity. I can still remember how that felt because I can feel it. It was like the scales fell from my eyes. And we do that all the time. The problem is you're not aware of it. And this process of getting clean, of, you know, once we're saved, of the sanctification process, becoming more Christ-like, Bill, is reawakening. You were dead, but now you're alive. And you see things clearly that you just can't. And it's a process that goes along. And God opens our eyes, and I think doesn't do it all at once, Bill, because he cares for us and loves us. So we realize how dependent we are on him.
Mm-hmm. One of the, go ahead, George.
No, I was done.
Yeah. One of the nice parts of community in recovery groups, like an Al-Anon or a group like that, is you do have the chance to say what's going on in your life, and you can bounce stuff off people. 'Cause if you're made to feel like you're nuts, because that's what the addict in your life is doing to you, it's a good place to go and say, this is what I heard today, or this is what I've been going through recently. And you have some sane, rational support at those groups. That's why we always want to encourage people to get into a recovery group of some kind if they're struggling.
I think one of the greatest things we get is that we're not unique.
Mm-hmm.
That we're not the world's worst person who ever lived. Yeah. And isn't going to get better. It also can help you to take yourself less seriously,
mm-hmm.
in that you meet other people that have a common concern, a common interest, and you see how they're walking it out,
yeah.
with the help of God in a good group.
Yeah.
And not being alone, Bill, addiction is, and most of the sinful behaviors that become addictions are a situation of being alone.
Yeah. Well, let's take a little break and then meet our guest. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. After a short break, we'll bring on our guest, Rosella. Be right back. On the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill and George, we're so glad that you've joined us tonight. If you just started listening to Real Recovery, where have you been? We've been around a while, and we're so glad that we've got a chance to have another spectacular story that we're going to hear tonight. We have our guest in studio, Rosella, who's joining us. And George, she's got quite a story. Not to mention, George, 41 and a half years of attending Al-Anon.
Wow.
Need I say more? Obviously not.
it's a staggering number.
It's a big number. Yeah, big number. And you have how many years of sobriety, George? 36?
Are these questions going to get harder?
No, this would be the toughest 36. Question you'll get today. How many?
36. 36.
Good for you. And praise be to God.
Totally. It's not a George deal. I'm still out there.
Yeah. So welcome to the program, Rosella. Rosella, hi.
Hi.
So glad that you could join us tonight. 41 and a half years of Al-Anon is quite a run.
It is quite a run. It's been wonderful. It's truly changed my life. And I have been in other 12-step programs, too. I spent 11 years in Overeaters Anonymous and 7 years in Adult Children of Alcoholics, 10 years in Clutters Anonymous. And what's funny is the first year, nothing, my house didn't change, my car didn't change, but I was on time to more events in that year than I had been the rest of my life put together.
It's interesting. So you find great fellowship in these groups, and you find them to be a wonderful part of life for you.
But yes, Glenn Pickering talked about, like, our biggest need is to belong.
Mm-hmm.
And that the 12-step groups, they concentrate on the 12 steps, and it's a spiritual program. And I remember the first time I went, I thought, I have always wanted to get close to God. And here are these 12 steps that show me how. Because when I was younger, like, read your Bible and pray every day, I just had this longing to be close to God. And it was like, how do you do that? And everybody, read your Bible, pray, you know. But this was like, I could see that this is what you do to get close to God. And that at the very first meeting, which was an Over Years Anonymous meeting, there was a woman from Duluth who never saw her again. And she talked very boldly about her relationship with God. And that gave me permission to reclaim my relationship with God,
nice.
Which had been missing in my relationship with my husband. And it was like I had been walking with my back to the light, and I just saw these long shadows. And I turned around, and the world was in color.
Wow. Sounds like a movie that George once saw called The Wizard of Something. Right, George?
That's it. That's a Glenn Rank.
Oh, nice.
One of our speakers that we know. Yeah.
Yeah, tremendous. So you had an alcoholic parent?
No.
Okay,
no.
You did not.
But I learned recently that my grandfather was alcoholic.
Okay.
And so my dad being raised by an alcoholic, that made a lot of sense.
Sure.
And my both sets of grandparents had been divorced, which is very unusual for the 1920s. And my grandfather in particular remarried someone who had been a housekeeper in their home. And pretended that he hadn't been married the first time. Hmm. So when I was a little 4-year-old, my mother said, you can't call him grandpa because the other boys don't know that Bob's their brother.
Hmm.
And so, and when they found out, I didn't see him again for another 15 years. But he was in Winona, this little small town, and my dad looked just like him, you know. But my mother had mental health issues, and she probably had borderline personality, but they didn't have that as a diagnosis while she was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so borderline personality is usually based on abandonment. So when she was 7, her father left her mother alone with 6 children to raise. And she was 7 years old and had been his favorite. And then in 1941, she gets married at the end of August. And then Pearl Harbor happens a couple months later. And the love of her life has to go away to war.
Hmm.
And so she had a lot of abandonment things going on. And then I think my father actually contributed quite a bit to it. And the first time my first husband met my parents, he took me aside later and said, you know, when your mom's acting normal, you and your dad egg her on to make her act abnormal.
Interesting.
And they were violent when I was young and were sentenced to counseling. And my mother went to Mounds Park Mental Hospital for a month when I was 6. And then a year later, my father tried to have her committed and didn't work. She got out after 9 days. And she spent the rest of her life telling anyone who would listen about it. Mm-hmm. And not realizing that she looked pretty crazy doing mm-hmm. that. And so it was a very difficult. I think my father was just tired of being a parent. And when I was 7, after the attempted I was the incarceration. My mother just gave up on being a mother, mm-hmm. and she concentrated on other families.
Yeah. So going back into your story, you were married at 19, and your husband had a drinking problem.
No, I was supporting him at 19.
Got you. All right.
I got married at 24.
I never read my notes carefully enough.
Oh, no. I kind of left that little. I thought of putting I got married at 24 to him, but yeah, and so he was my freshman calculus teacher, and I saw later that he never prepared for class at all. And it was funny because I got a 765 on my SAT in math, so I'm in the 99.99th percentile, and I got a C in calculus. and he never presented anything. And I'm a sub-audio reader and listener. I need to know the name for those symbols. And he never said them. He'd just take questions from people, and then he'd spend the hour writing them all out. And it was all, you know, I copied it all, but I had no idea what the words were from my head. So, yes, he did have an alcohol problem, and I guess I kind of ignored that. And some of those years we were too poor for him to drink. But he would get drunk every night, basically. And he was older than I was. He went to a better college than I did. And I just sort of, and of course, as a codependent, and I used to be like off the scale codependent, you know, out of 82, I had 79. characteristics. And the more characteristics you have, the worse you feel. And so it wasn't until after we separated that I heard a thing on the radio that KOM and Hazleton were having a show on treatment centers and alcoholism in Minnesota. And a psychologist said they did an experiment with two strangers in a room, and they would videotape their conversation. And half the groups, they gave each person one mild alcoholic drink. And when they watched those videos, they were not really talking to each other. They were interrupting. They were talking past each other, talking at the same time. And when those same people had an exit interview and they talked about their experience, they said, oh, we were sharing our souls.
Wow.
And I could have had a V8 hit my head.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's what happened to our marriage, because Gil is drunk every night. And he said, oh, we're sharing our souls. And I'm going, there's nothing going on here.
Well, there's the grand illusion. He thinks he's in an intimate relationship with you, and it couldn't be anything further from the truth.
It's true. And then I was blessed to get the first codependency counselor that Health Partners ever hired. And she was great. In fact, Gil liked her. Gil liked what the changes I was making so much that he wanted to see her. And so we went together, and I could see clearly she's giving him a chemical dependency evaluation, and he was oblivious to that. But she, of course, recommended treatment. But a while later, we did marriage counseling, and she had a. My counselor had a firm rule that when you're marriage counseling, you don't come back to your regular counselor. You just deal with the marriage counseling. So that didn't last terribly long. And my first session, I came back, I said, well, so-and-so said that you did all the work and Gil didn't do any. And then she said, oops, I'm not supposed to say anything. And it was like, I wouldn't have known that. I mean, I wouldn't have realized that unless she had said it. And why didn't the counselor say that in session?
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't know.
Yeah.
You know.
So what kind of behaviors did he exhibit towards you? If he's drinking every night and you are trying to be supportive and trying to have a marriage, what was he doing that was causing problems?
Well,
yeah, I mean, besides being drunk in the house, of course. But
well, he was, you know, he had a master's degree and he worked for KTEL for 5 years. So he was seriously underemployed. I mean, and
I don't know what that means. So
what?
I mean, that he worked for KTEL, so he was seriously underemployed. I don't know what that means.
Okay, so he's got a master's degree and he's working in a warehouse.
Okay.
You know, and he's maybe filling orders or moving boxes around or
kind
of thing.
Okay.
And there was a lot of gaslighting going on, like it was all my problem. Like before I went to Al-Anon, I started in Overeaters Anonymous because at size 12, he had convinced me that I had, that I was a compulsive overeater, and this was all my fault. I think one of the bigger effects of the drinking was that he really wasn't interested in sex. And although he had Playboy and Penthouse and other things, you know, so that was really, really painful. I remember going to my first fifth step, and the person I was doing it with, she asked a few questions, and it was like, you mean it's not my fault? Because Gil had a million reasons why it wasn't, and it was killing me.
Mm-hmm.
It was just draining the blood from me because, you know, there's no vocabulary in our culture for women who aren't wanted by their husbands.
Mm-hmm. George, does this seem like a typical response if someone is an alcoholic, or or drug user to try to use something against a spouse and try to make it their fault. And you've got an overeating problem, so now everything is your problem, not mine. It's a deflection, isn't it?
Well, every case is different, but there's some general patterns. And basically what I'm going to do is try to keep everything I can to keep using. So if you're nagging me or hounding me, kind of like you get paid to do on our show, I'm gonna tell you why it's your fault, why I'm doing it. And you kind of, that's your God is your chemical or your behavior. And you're going to do whatever you can. And if somebody corrects you, gives you feedback, like who wants feedback when they're drinking, you're going to do whatever you can to minimize it, reduce it. And if you can spin it back on the other person, well, that's a strategy for sure.
Well, and I really wasn't nagging him, but I was so, my identity was so based on other people and their reaction to me that I was like trying to be better, trying to do it right or whatever. You know, when I was taking on a lot of the responsibility, which I later found out wasn't mine and wasn't my fault. And
Let me clarify the nagging. That's the perception. When somebody's giving you feedback, you don't want feedback. And so that's an example of spinning that back. You think it's nagging and you don't want to hear it. So you're in a no-win situation when you're dealing with somebody who's trying to protect their using. Fair?
Yeah. Yeah. And then protecting their supply, you know, going down the stairs when they can hardly walk to make sure that glass is filled. And actually, we did just a tiny bit of marriage counseling at another point shortly after I returned from the 5-day Hazleton family program. And he said, well, what's wrong with one little drink? And then a few years later, my son asked what drunk was. And I said, I'll get a card from work from the intoxilizer. Well, it turns out that drink had 8 ounces of scotch in it, and Gil only weighed 150 pounds.
And that was his one little drink?
It's his one little drink, which would get him 2.5 times the legal limit to drive.
Wow.
What's wrong with one little drink every night?
There's that rationalization, George.
Well, you get quite creative, Bill. But it shows how serious the delusion is. Mm-hmm. You've got somebody that really cares about you that's telling you the truth. And not only do you not want to hear it, you deflect it back on them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really be mad at this. I think your perception of reality is wrong. And it's really horrendous if you're on the other side of it because you've got somebody you love. You're watching them destroy themselves, and then they're partially blaming you.
Yeah,
it's awful.
Yeah, it is. We're going to take a little break. You're listening to The Real Recovery with Bill and George. We're so glad you've joined us tonight. We'll be back in just a minute. Back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We're so glad that you've joined us tonight. We're talking to Rosella. Quite a story. 41 and a half years of Al-Anon, and she has been in a relationship we're talking about with her ex-husband, who was kind of a... Was he a blackout drinker?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, his motto was, everybody has blackouts.
Okay.
And he didn't have to be drunk to be having a blackout. It took me many years to realize that if we had a conversation, he wouldn't remember it the next day. So if we had solved some problem in our marriage,
didn't matter.
Yeah. And I remember what George was saying about punishing people. I think for Gil, the main punishment was to pull away from me emotionally, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of gaslighting going on. And I remember one time I had trouble getting the stove lit, had a pilot light, and so I finally got it lit, and he came over and he turned it off. He said, that was too much work. And then he walks out for 3 hours. So that kind of rejection, you know, that he would, and that not talking about things, And the pulling away, that was one of his main ways of controlling me.
Yeah. Well, George hasn't turned his stove on in 3 years because it's too much work.
So. Is that true, George?
No, it's more like 20.
We had a Secretary of State who, when she looked for apartments, said, "Do I have to have a stove? Microwave's plenty."
Wow. So, Rosella, let's ask, I want to ask you about the place you were at spiritually during these troubling years. What was going on spiritually at that time?
I would say I was seriously backslidden.
So you had had a saving faith experience with Jesus?
Yes.
Prior to that, things sort of went on the back burner?
My mother was Pentecostal. I sometimes say she put the hostel in Pentecostal because she had mental health issues. And my father was Unitarian. And in fifth grade, I started going to a Baptist church with my friend Carol. And then I went to Camp Lebanon and accepted Christ there. And neither of my parents was very happy. Because one, I wasn't conservative enough, and one was way too conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And then throughout high school, my faith was really important to me. And at seventh grade, I started going to a bigger church, and I got to join the youth group at the end of seventh grade. And that was really a safe haven. And the people in that church were my family. They showed me what ordinary people lived like and how to be kind to your spouse. And I mean, totally foreign ideas. And that was a real blessing. I can't believe that wasn't real. It was real. It was very real. And it's what kept me going. Got into college, had avoided boys during high school because I needed to study and get out. And got into college, got sexually involved with my boyfriend. He refused to live with me because then people could accuse us of having sex. Funny thing. And so I felt very unaccepted by him. And then I sort of felt like nobody who really has my beliefs is going to accept me. So then I was looking for somebody who's going to accept me. And that led me to Gil. And Gil was into Alan Watts, kind of New Age type stuff. And he said, "Oh, we'll agree to disagree." But what he really meant was, "I'll decide you're wrong." And so, and it was really when I came to OA that it's like a switch turned on, and I had permission, and I realized when I was even thinking about God, Gil would be sending me these messages, like we'd be in the car driving, and it was like he'd send me these messages, you're crazy. And it's that's a wonderful thing about the 12-step groups, too, because we're all trying to improve our spiritual life and get closer to God. And it's a very, very real thing. So the 12-step programs brought me back to a relationship with God. And I'm grateful. I'm so grateful.
Mm-hmm. You got a couple of verses that you're living out to this day, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Now, I worked for 33 years as a crime scene and accident photographer for the state of Minnesota. And during that time, my life verse was, "Be not overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." And now my life verse is Zephaniah 3:17, "The Lord your God is with you. He is mighty to save. He will take great delight in you. He will rejoice over you with singing." Let's see. I left out a line, but they're all wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
"He will quiet you with his love, and he will rejoice over you with singing."
Mm-hmm. So, George, Rosella worked for 33 years in the crime scene business, photographing. That's a pretty remarkable career.
You know, that was very interesting. I wanted to ask you, is there a way you can make a crime look like an accident?
Are you asking personally for yourself? we actually had an arson specialist who was had a cabin in Wisconsin and was asked at a bar by somebody, "Well, how do you burn down your cabin to get insurance money?" And she thought it was a joke, and she had a few beers, and so she told him and didn't realize he was wired, and she lost her job. So I can't tell you. But we did. There are ways you could make a suicide look like an accident.
That's not where I was going with it.
But the thought is that it might be a lot nicer for the people left behind if they thought this was an accident rather than you had deliberately left them.
Did you like that line of work?
You know, most of the time I spent in the lab, and I was really ideally suited for this. I've got a real good eye artistically. I've got degrees in art, and I'm very mechanical. And so I could run this expensive equipment and get beautiful pictures out of it. And the people I was serving loved it. See, now I'm a people pleaser. So producing stuff that people loved. And one trooper sent me a letter saying that he sat down with the defense attorney and showed him the pictures. And they said, okay, I think we'll plead. And so to know that I was making a difference and that I was producing high quality work in a short period of time that actually helped people on their jobs, it was very satisfying. And looking back, it was really ideally suited to me. And not too much of it was dead bodies. Even the State Patrol stuff, they didn't always take pictures at fatalities. So there were a lot of banged up cars and things. And then I developed everybody's pictures, no matter who took them. But when I was on the crime scene team for 5 years, I was the one taking the picture. You start outside the building and get all, you know, four sides of the building, and then you go room by room through each room and make sure everything's photographed, and then you gradually work your way to the dead body. And half the time the dead body's gone. You know, and there are little debris from the paramedics.
Mm. Yeah, Rosella said maybe if there were six rolls of film, five would be the building and one roll would be the dead body.
Wow. I'm just curious, listening to the story. Your personal life was very difficult. Mm-hmm. And yet your job is too. Is that by accident, do you think?
You know, at the time, I remember somebody in Adult Children of Alcoholics, and I was talking to her, and you mentioned something about my job, and she was a counselor, and she said, and it's triggering you. And I'm going, it's not triggering me. And I think I was able to detach from it in a lot of ways. The very first day I was at the State Patrol, I had the insight that if a person was in the car, they were either all right, already dead, or they're working to get them out. And that they were going to do everything they could to help that person. And that was kind of reassuring, you know, that that these were professionals I was working with and for, and they would do all they could. And somehow I was able to detach. Of course, I had already been in, you know, or I started Overeaters Anonymous and then Al-Anon right about the time I started that job. And so I think that my 12-step experience, learning to detach with love, et cetera, and not get emotionally involved in things that aren't appropriate to be involved in emotionally, I think that helped a lot.
Okay.
So, Rosella, you ended up having another relationship, and that had its own little twists and turns, didn't it?
Yeah. So I divorced Gil 36 years ago. I bought my house, and mm-hmm. Some people said I was married to my house because I'm good at home repairs, and there were sure a lot that were needed. And I had 7 years where I went to five meetings a week. I think I went to two Overeaters Anonymous, two Al-Anon, and an Adult Children of Alcoholic every week. And we had shared custody, so on the nights when Gil was taking care of our son, then I could go to meetings. And so that was a wonderful time of recovery, and I went to a lot of workshops and seminars and things. And then at a Quaker retreat, I had become a Quaker at the time, at a Quaker retreat I met this guy, and he seemed pretty nice, and I was... it was the summer before my 39th birthday, and I was very aware of my biological time clock ticking down. And I sort of felt like Cinderella at the ball, except that I realized that it only chimed 11 times and I could go back and dance for another hour. And I tell people that my second husband was the world's greatest actor. Before we got married, he acted really nice, and you should see how he acted afterwards. And it turned out that he was quite narcissistic as well as having other mental health problems. And so it was just difficult. He used anger to control everything. I was just walking on eggshells for 10 years. And after 10 and a half years, he announced that he was really a woman inside. And I can assure you he was not a woman anywhere. But I realized that was his... his life wasn't working out and he didn't feel good about his life. And so he, that to him, that must be it. And it turned out he'd gone into nursing because it was a women's field.
Hmm.
But he only did a small amount of work in nursing. So, he had three jobs the first year we were married and got fired from the last one about 5 weeks before our daughter was born. And I ended up going back to work much earlier than I planned to because I was home 6 weeks and he didn't cook a single meal. You know, and I just had this baby and, you know, was nursing her and had to go to somebody had to go to Walgreens when she was a week old. And the pharmacist said to me, you know, you're walking real slow. What's going on? I said, well, I had a baby a week ago. She said, you got to take care of yourself. And I thought, there's something wrong with the world when the pharmacist cares more about me than my husband.
Mm-hmm. It's very troubling to hear. I'm sorry about that. That's a difficult situation, George. And I feel her pain and feel the sadness of someone who feels like they're not getting the support they need. That's troubling.
Yeah, always, Bill. Well said.
All right, George, we're going to take a little break here, and then we'll come back and continue to hear more of Rosella's story. She's been in support groups, Al-Anon, for 41 and a half years, and it's been a real refuge for her to be in that kind of fellowship. And if you are in need of community, you need to reach out. You need to have someone hear your story, identify with what you're going through, and even help you get closer to the Lord Jesus Christ. You may just well find it in a recovery group because there's plenty of people there that are seeking the Lord, and it's really good just to be involved in fellowship and community. So we'll take a little break, and when we come back, lots more Real Recovery with Bill and George. We got Ryan on the board tonight. We'll be right back. We are back with our guest, Rosella, tonight. So glad you joined us, Bill and George, in Real Recovery. Thank you for being part of this journey with us. I hope you are learning and growing in your faith. I hope that you are finding sobriety and peace and contentment. And Rosella, our guest tonight, has gone through a lot, and God has been journeying with her the whole way through. Rosella, I want to hear more about how Jesus has been your constant comfort and joy. How you got there?
When I was married to Tom, my second husband, he would leave in the morning to take our daughter to school, and I would lay down on our Turkish rug and just pray. You know, it was really difficult, and I really felt like God was calling me to minister God's love to him, because he had a lot of mental health problems. And then when he made his stunning announcement, I felt like God was like, okay, Rosella, how bad does that have to be? You're free. And so I really did feel free at that time. Tom, my second husband, was easily offended. And so we had gone through a whole series of different churches, and I'm actually still involved with several of them. And I think between the two marriages, there was a point when I go, you know, do I want to let other people know I'm a Christian? Because I feel like if I don't do it just right, it's the perfectionism, that you got to be perfect. And I thought, you know, this is real. This is very real. And so I have been involved in the church ever since I left Lee and Gill. And I was a Quaker for a while, and then that kind of, the Quakers in Kansas are real believers. And in the Twin Cities, they're kind of new agey. Oh. And so I gradually got out of that. And then I'm learning is real big for me. So I've been to a lot of seminars and different things. But years ago, Chapel of the Year had their 40-day spiritual adventures. And after 40 days of kind of guided Bible reading, it's like, I want to do more. And then I read the one-year Bible. And then just a lot of things drawing me closer and closer to God. And then about 12 years ago, some friends at church did a 12, it was a coordinated 12-step recovery, the 8 steps to celebrate recovery, thoroughly biblical, and it incorporated all the latest brain skills. And Jim Wilder would do the brain minute in every video. You know, there'd be like a 2-minute brain segment on it, which was fascinating because they show spec scans of people who would just use marijuana every weekend for 20 years and parts of their brain were just dead. And so I got into this brain skill thing, and the basic idea is that we can teach each other as adults things that we didn't get as children. So if the bonding stage were missed when you were a child, you can do that later with another person who understands and cares for you. And one of the big ideas is that joy and gratitude is the gateway to joy. And that if you build up your joy, they define trauma as the inability to return to joy after a negative emotional experience. And so the more joy you had, the better able you were to withstand difficult events. And when Jim Wilder was on Susie Larson the first time in July a few years ago, he mentioned towards the end of it that when he does counseling, he works on building up people's joy for a year before they start mucking in the weeds.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times counseling will get you, it'll just muddy the water. And before that, you could have skimmed off some clear water and drunk it, but now you can't even drink the water. And a lot of times counseling just brings things up, gets you feeling emotional, and then has no resolution for it. And then you feel worse. And the things I found have been very effective have been peer counseling, theophostic prayer, and Emmanuel prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of my big experiences in theophostic prayer was it was maybe a year or two after my father had died, and I went into serious counseling after he died because I knew I'd never get the relationship with him that I wanted. And I deliberately chose a male counselor because it's just too easy to complain about men if you're with a female counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was men I was having the issues with. And so, but I had an experience with Jesus where he was holding me as a baby, and he looked down at me and said, "She's perfect. She's just what I wanted."
Mm-hmm.
And I'd grown up believing that my parents really wanted a boy, and that's why they couldn't love me. Well, it was their own issues that they couldn't love me.
Right.
And but I was, you know, spent my whole life trying to be lovable. And then Jesus was sort of doing the coochie-coo type things. And a few months later, I went to another thing at church and briefly did theophostic prayer with Julie Zelke. And I told her that Jesus was doing the coochie-coo thing, you know, and she said, "Are you going to let yourself laugh with Jesus?" And so, yeah, I'm going to let myself laugh with Jesus. So I think realizing God's love for me and how much God cherishes me, that has really changed my life, and that God has made us for joy alternating with rest, and that we have this amazing capacity in Christ to just build that joy.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I've learned this. And I have a technique I call the garbage list when things are going wrong. I think I first did this when I had 3 major car repairs in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later, I'm still feeling the emotional weight of it, even though they've been fixed. So I wrote out my garbage list, and it's like, just then you clear your mind out. You don't have to have it rattling in your head. And then if you want to look up why you were upset, there it is. And then later I remember writing a garbage list, and there was nothing big, but there were about 20 little things. I go, no wonder I'm feeling out of sorts. And after a while, I started writing my gratitude list. So after the garbage list, I write a gratitude list. Well, a couple of days ago, I tried writing a garbage list, and I just immediately went to the gratitude side.
Sweet.
You know? Yeah. So my plumbing went out when we had the cold snap, and I was without water for 2.5 weeks. I call it my soggy saga because I had 14 inches of water in my root cellar that I had to wade through to turn off the valve.
Wow.
Twice.
Wow.
And
should have had George go over and do that. He would have done that for you, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, that would be difficult. So it's hard enough getting the plumber in there. And but we had to wait till everything, the water receded. Yeah. Plumber can't work in the water. And but I started writing out my garbage list on that. And then after each point, I'm going, you know, but I had the money to do it. And I took the right precautions. And I didn't get hypothermia. You know, on the second time, it was pretty easy to just, you know, I got to do it. You know, instead of vacillating about, can I do it some other way? No, mm-hmm. you got to do it. Do the precautions. Do it. And so it's interesting how there's been a change where it's not just the garbage. It's like, but there's the grateful side of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so... And the other thing, verses like, God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of sound mind. And so I had a potential cancer scare and a major surgery this summer. And I was just very aware that worrying about it wasn't going to make it any better. It was just going to make it worse. And so that I could, you know, just trust in God. And like my friend at Love Lines, I volunteered at a crisis phone line. And my friend said, well, the worst thing that happens, you go home and be with Jesus. And it's like, yeah, the worst thing, you live and you're in a lot of pain. But
right.
Didn't have that. And I think, you know, it's funny because I work at a crisis phone line, like after all I've been through. And actually, the many of the experiences I've had and even watching some of my daughter's struggles, that those have helped other people now. And that those have been redeemed because... They can reassure someone else now. They can help someone else now. They can let someone else have hope and joy. And I frequently encourage people to make joy lists and then do it, especially if they're feeling down. Go to your joy list and do something. And maybe it's eating a chocolate ice cream. Maybe it's taking a walk or playing with a dog, visiting a friend. You know, whatever it is that brings you joy, build those things into your life because you need them.
Everything you just said is entirely on George's list. Isn't that true, George?
Yeah, I'm always looking to make things a little better, right,
yeah.
Bill?
Eat some chocolate, play with your dog, talk to a friend. It's pretty much what you do every day.
Hopefully he didn't hear that.
Who's he?
Yeah, I definitely, I think we need to make our recovery better than our using, for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Absolutely.
I love the fact that Rosella's spirit and her attitude is gone from listing out her garbage stuff to gravitating more quickly to the gratitude side. When you have,
I love that, Bill. During COVID, we've talked about many times on this program. It's not what we can't do. What can we do?
Mm-hmm.
It's not what we don't have. It's what do we do have? It's a choice, and I couldn't agree with that more.
I love the fact that the gratitude produces the joy. So it's just a nice byproduct of gratitude is joy. And we all
well work. I look at it, you know, even when we do the show, I get to see you once a week, and I'm grateful I get to see you once a week.
We're all grateful, George. As you know, that wraps up yet another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Any parting thoughts?
Your experience can help other people, and you can do anything for one day. You got to make the decision, though, to do it. And your life can be their present reality of one of hope and recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Because God does work. And if you're thinking, I don't want to do this, I can't do this, you're right on both counts. But it's not up to you.
Yeah, so true.
The person you are right now uses. But God can transform you into a person who doesn't use.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to the show tonight and listening to Real Recovery. George and I appreciate it so much. Over 10 years, we've enjoyed doing this program. And starting April 6th, our spring share is happening, and we would love for you to participate because your support makes shows like this possible. Thank you so much. We will do this again next week. Have a great week, everyone. Good night, and God bless. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.